So my name is Chris Van Pelt. I am co-founder and chief information security officer at Weights & Biases. I like my coffee as a good old French press. Maybe with, oh look, I've got my little emoji too. French press, a little oat milk lately has been more my jam. Sometimes half and half. But yeah, just a good French press. But it's like good beans, you know, like the fancy hipster coffee shop for sure.
This is another MLOps Community Podcast. I am your host, Dimitri Oz, and what an episode we have today with Chris, who is the CISO at Weights & Biases. Weights & Biases, of course, you've probably heard of them. They are huge. They are killing it. They've been in the game for so long, helping researchers, engineers, and now, even more so, the developers of the world use and take advantage of machine learning. It started with the predictive ML, went into the deep learning. Now we're all in that LLMs world and how they are tailoring their product to capture all this energy that's out there in the LLM world. Chris talked to me about his first iteration, which was a company, and many of you who know the story of machine learning probably know that Chris has been in the game for a long time. I mean, since 2007, he talks about his first company that he built with Lucas, the co-founder of Weights & Biases, and that is Crowdflower. And he goes through what they were doing, the pain that they were trying to alleviate when they built Crowdflower, and then how him and Lucas transitioned out of that. They spent some time just getting back into the machine learning world after that startup. And they realized, you know what? I think there's a possibility for another company. And they did it again. We might as well just call these folks serial entrepreneurs. So Chris then goes into talking to me about building products and building WandDB and how the product has evolved, and what some of these big features that have come in over the years, they've come in over the years into the product, and how they decide which features are relevant and then how they A/B test them and get them. I love this phrase that he used, which is like demo-driven development. So they go out to customers and they say, you know, here's a demo of this minimum viable product that they have, and they tell the story around it, and they see what the interest is with customers and what they would want and how they would change it. And then he was very honest that once you get something out there that customers are using, that is really day zero, and that is when you need to start the true process of iterating it and making it something that customers truly love. So I appreciate Chris being very open with me and transparent on how they're building product, also on his security lifestyle these days. I mean, he's the CISO, right? So he gave us some hints on what to do to make sure that you are secure when it comes to building products and using products. And we then later talked about personas and how you build for different personas in this ever rapidly changing environment. Let's get into the full conversation with Chris. And a huge shout out to Weights & Biases for sponsoring this episode. If you would like to find out more about any of the stuff that we talked about in the episode, especially the evaluation and monitoring part of Weights & Biases, you can click the link in the description or just go to wandb.ai and you can see it all for yourself. Now let's get into this episode with Chris. And if you enjoy it, please share it with one friend. So I want to talk all about the inception. Basically, I want to talk about you and your journey. And I also want to talk about Weights & Biases because I think they're very intertwined, I guess we could say. And I think there's a lot of places that we may go off track and probably talk about information security or talk about the new LLM landscape and all that stuff. But let's just start with this first question, which is, what is Crowdflower?
Yeah, Crowdflower, blast from the past. That was my first startup. So Lucas Waits and Bias, the CEO and my co-founder, he and I started a company in 2007. So just before that recession, it was like the perfect time to start a company.
Yeah.
Lucas and I met at a startup called PowerSet in San Francisco. And PowerSet was a technology company making a search engine, but they were using natural language processing to make that search engine better. And Lucas was actually doing machine learning at the company. He was responsible for the ranking algorithm, so how we chose to sort the results coming back for any given query. And we needed a lot of labeled data to train that algorithm. So at PowerSet, we started using Amazon Mechanical Turk, which a lot of people don't know this, but it was actually the first Amazon Web Service. So like even before like S3, I believe. We might want to fact check this, but it was a very, very early Amazon Web Service. And we used it at PowerSet, and we were blown away by the ability to get labeled data very quickly by just sending it out to people on the internet that were willing to do these micro tasks, or basically a short labeling task. At PowerSet, it was, here's a query, here's a result, rate this result on a scale of 1 to 5. And we started building some tools internally at PowerSet to help us with quality control and how to ensure that we were getting good labeled data for the algorithm. And we kind of stepped back and thought, hey, maybe there's a company here. Like, we could help other companies do this. We think machine learning's cool. And that's how it all kind of began. Yeah.
Dude, so ahead of the curve.
We were too ahead of the curve. We were way too early on the ML train, for sure. But we learned a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. 2007, doing stuff that I think people in 2023 are still trying to figure out how to do consistently and well. And you were like, okay, there's a company here. So how does Crowdflower differ from what then, and what was the trajectory of it?
I mean, we were young. We were like 26 years old when we started the company. And really, we're both programmers. So we love like using our computers to make cool stuff. But we had no idea how to run a business. So we had to learn a lot of lessons the hard way. But we learned, you know, a ton of valuable lessons. For sure, and in like what it takes to build a sales organization and to hire good talent. And you know, one of the first big mistakes we made was we had built this kind of tooling around microtasks, and then we thought, all right, let's just go to companies and offer to solve their labeling problem, almost as like a consultant.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly we found ourselves like in a consulting business, which is not a good business. We quickly found out that, especially in Silicon Valley, it's all about that subscription revenue. You need to somehow find a way to get subscriptions, which is kind of, it's hard with a problem like data labeling, because people want to buy just a set of labels and not necessarily kind of an ongoing service. So I mean, that's just one of like many, many lessons we learned. And the Crowdflower journey, it was like 10 years, lots of like ups and downs when we thought we had really, you know, things really going. And then we had to kind of step back and rethink what the product looked like, how it worked. But learned a lot for sure.
Okay. So what was the transition from Crowdflower to Weights and Biases?
Yeah. So eventually, after about 10 years, Crowdflower really started to hit its stride. It was working well, revenue was growing, and we had actually brought in another CEO to run the company to kind of free Luke and I up to take a break from just running things for 10 years and also think about maybe what was going to be next. So finally, after we kind of ended our relationship with Crowdflower, we were working on a few different things. So we had seen that deep learning was really, it was like working. It was taking off. We saw that at Crowdflower. It was, you know, a lot of the reason that the company finally started working, like all of these organizations needed lots and lots of data. And we saw that it was especially true in like computer vision and autonomy. So at Crowdflower, we were working with a lot of the bigger self-driving car ML teams. So we did a couple of things. One, we were like, well, we haven't been doing machine learning for a while. We should probably brush up on the fundamentals. So Luke started teaching classes on deep learning. We'd run like events in San Francisco to teach like regular software developers, hey, what is deep learning? How does it work? And we also were playing with robots quite a bit because we thought, okay, well, if there's people making these big self-driven cars, maybe we can make some like sick robots. And who doesn't, like, as an engineer, just like working with robots sounds like so much fun. And also at the same time, Lucas actually got an internship at OpenAI, which Luke and I are both based in San Francisco in the Mission District. Their office was right there. So Luke was able to go work on a robotics problem at OpenAI. He was working on like a grasping problem. So to figure out, you know, how the robot's going to plan its actions to pick up an arbitrary object.
This must have been early days of OpenAI.
It was very early. Yeah. It was like within a year of the inception. Yeah. So, you know, we kind of decided a hardware company working with robots was, as fun as it might be, it could be like a pretty hard business to make work. And while Luke was doing his internship at OpenAI and while we were like teaching classes, it became clear there just weren't great tools, especially when you're working with lots of other ML practitioners, to just keep track of all the stuff that you're doing. So the inception of Weights and Biases was like, make a tool that enables Luke to keep track of his grasping model. And as like a full stack software developer, which I identify as, this is like, it's my biggest dream. Like, you have this blank canvas, you have this exciting problem, you don't have the cruft of like 10 years of developing a big massive product. You can just go and kind of create something new. So I really threw myself into it, and we were able to make a very rough but functional prototype, I think, within a month or so. Yes, that's how it all began.
Well, thank you for giving me your pronouns, which are full and stack. And now I know how to address you. And so the cool thing about this, I feel like you probably saw Excel spreadsheets being passed around via email on like, hey, look, this is how I'm tracking my machine learning. And you saw it, and or Lucas saw it and probably thought, we could do way better than this.
Well, like Excel spreadsheets, those were like the more advanced experiment trackers. Like, most would just have this big text file with their own weird arbitrary format. Yeah,
it's so funny because I know even in 2019 when I went to ODSC then, and I remember talking to somebody and he was like, yeah, we just pass around Excel sheets and that's how we know which models are working or not. And I was like, what? We're in 2019. How is that possible? And so I am guessing that you saw the evolution to Excel spreadsheets and you were like, at least it's a step up from the text documents.
No, yeah, it's pretty, if you're using like a Google sheet, it's collaborative. You're like, you know.
Oh, that is killer. Dude, yeah. That is so wild to think about and to think like how far we've come. And it feels like you went out, you created Weights and Biases. You started with that single problem of like, hey, how can we track and how can we make it collaborative, right? So we understand. Or was there another thesis that was from the get-go you wanted to hit on?
Yeah, I mean, it was really just like keeping track of stuff. I do remember like Luke specifically for his grasping problem, he was like, what I really want is just be able to load this model up like on my phone and try it.
Oh.
Like in the real world, like take a picture of something and just see what it does. We haven't made the universal inference iPhone app yet, but I still, that's one that I would love to make. But yeah, I mean, also originally, like we weren't that visual, right? It was mainly about just keeping track of what script was run, what was the version of the code, what hyperparameters were passed in, what model was generated. And then we kind of quickly saw just by working with users that they really, you know, like seeing all of the loss curves, accuracy curves. At the time, we kind of thought like, well, TensorBoard's like good enough there. But yeah, it turned out, you know, to be like probably the defining feature of weights and biases, the kind of visualizations and charts. Yeah.
Well, talk me through how that change of the product, like what has the evolution been in your eyes? You've seen it go from that basic one, and then you're talking to users and you realize, whoa, we need visualization. And then what other iterations felt like big unlocks for you along the way?
Yeah. You know, in the beginning, we had an idea of what we wanted to make like for ourselves, but we have no idea if anyone else wants it. And getting people to just like listen or care is, it's daunting. It's very hard. And there's a lot of no's or don't care. So in the beginning, it was, you know, a lot of just like iterating on the core tracking stuff and then just wondering like, is this something that we'll ever find product market fit? One of the early features that we were a bit surprised by, but I think proved to be another really powerful feature of weights and biases was hyperparameter sweeps. So we were working with Toyota Research Institute, and they were saying like, hey, if you could make it easier for us to run sweeps, that would be awesome. And we were kind of thinking like, well, we're not going to make some magic algorithm that's going to search the hyperparameter space better. There's plenty of other like tools out there that can orchestrate these things. Everybody's infrastructure is slightly different. Like how could we really provide value here? And the idea was just like making it really simple to run agents wherever, whether you're in Kubernetes, Slurm, or some homegrown orchestration system, and then provide like really nice visualizations and simple, you know, kind of reading the literature and saying, all right, what hyperparameter algorithms are working, and just implement it, open source it, say it's here. That proved to be a really popular feature with folks. Then you kind of step back and you think, all right, well, how big do we want to dream? Like what could we kind of ultimately build here that makes us the kind of de facto collaboration visualization tool for ML? And it was pretty clear from the beginning. It's like, all right, well, we need really good data set and model management functionality. So we created Artifacts, which is kind of a version big data store. We need really good kind of evaluation functionality to be able to, for any given ML use case, have nice, rich kind of tables and to be able to run analysis on top of them. Most recently, it's been 4 years now since we kind of laid out this big vision, we released the production monitoring kind of on the inference side. Historically, we've been, you know, mainly on the training part of the pipeline and evaluation parts of the pipeline. Now we have offerings at inference time to be able to kind of get those evaluation results in and connect to like CI or CD and kick off reevaluation. So, you know, in the beginning, it was just like keep track models. Then it became clear it was working. We're like, how big could we go? What are the biggest problem points? Today we're closer than ever at being like a truly end-to-end ML ops platform.
Yeah, and it feels like the idea of like, okay, we've got this one thing, we figured it out, and now we can spread, like let's land and expand and see where else people are asking for help because they're having pain, is a great way of doing it. At some point, you switched into the CISO role, right? What did that look like and how did that transition happen?
Yeah, so at Crowdflower, I ended up often being the technical representative, going out with the sales team, especially for the like really large deals. And I became very familiar with working with the InfoSec teams about, you know, how our software works, what practices we have at the company to ensure that software is secure, and had done this a lot at Crowdflower. As a developer, I've also like shipped my fair share of like bad bugs. So I like viscerally feel the pain of, you know, doing something that, you know, at Crowdflower, we would do we had these micro tasks, which means we pay people like cents to complete some labeling task. And there were like a handful of times, and they weren't always my bugs, but one or two of them were my bugs where, you know, everyone on the internet is trying to game this system. Like if they can just do the work without actually doing the work and get paid, then, you know, that's just easy money for them. And there, you know, sometimes be little bugs there that cost us tens of thousands of dollars. You can like really feel it. So I've always like cared a lot about security. And originally my title at Weights & Biases was CBP, which is also, those are my initials, Chris Van Pelt. But it kind of sounds like corporate vice president. In the early days of Crowdflower, I think my title was like Chief Awesome Officer, which I thought was funny. But anyway, I needed a title that like made sense. And given my past experience, we went with Chief Information Security Officer. Since, you know, I've been able to build this like amazing team of really passionate security folks, and I've seen the security industry at large really kind of mature as well with better tooling for the compliance programs that need to be run, like SOC 2 or ISO 27001, and a lot of the like code, static code analysis and those deeper tools, which in this current kind of explosion of AI, I think there's going to be a lot of really cool security-related functionality coming out as well. So, yeah.
There's so many things that I want to ask you on this security thread. And really, if I think we could probably start with, as a machine learning engineer who is tangentially related to the InfoSec or DevSecOps teams, what are some things that you can give us as advice, as like easy wins to make sure that, A, if we are bringing on new tooling, we've got our checks and balances and we're good on that? And then B, just like in general, how can we assure success?
I think first, like start thinking about it from the beginning. Like even when you are a small startup working on something, there are, you know, a few things that will go a long way in ensuring you're going to be able to develop software securely. So one is like least privilege, which is, it's tricky, but it's really important. So like the easiest thing when you're like giving new engineers access to say your AWS account is give them like some permissions that let them do basically like everything. That is bad. You want to, you know, limit the permissions of what anyone on the team can do, and hopefully get that into Terraform and make it really easy to maybe give people temporary escalations and then bring them down. The other pieces are just using good security tooling. So set up scanning of any Docker containers that are being built for CVEs. If you ever deliver these to enterprise customers, they're going to find them before you do if you aren't doing that, which is embarrassing. And it should be easy to just update the dependencies there, and have, you know, a vulnerability kind of management system like Dependabot on GitHub will tell you. I think it's especially gnarly in the JavaScript ecosystem. There's just so many dependencies and so many CVEs out there, but staying on top of that is important because your customers can see it and their teams are going to be concerned about these things.
Dang.
What else? Yeah. I mean, keep track of vendors. Like from the beginning, when you decide to like use some third-party service, first step back and say, okay, what data are we giving them and what classification does it fall into? So you can think of like highly confidential, kind of secret, but not terribly confidential, and then just low risk. And for anything high, you should be like confident that they are a mature vendor that has like a SOC 2 type 2 attestation or some accreditation, because eventually you're going to have to tell your customers who your subprocessors are. And they're going to, you know, be pretty concerned if you're using this other, you know, brand new startup that maybe won't have those accreditations. But.
And so now thinking about like this new paradigm, I feel like it's a good place to transition into LLMs and how much it's the wild, wild west in this space. And almost like as you are looking at LLMs and trying to think through like security and data access or just like the potential problems that you get, have you got any advice on that front? Like, have you figured out ways to go about it to cover your ass there?
Yeah, I mean, it very much is the Wild Wild West. Every large enterprise that I've talked to, like some team is working on this and just like using LLMs within their business. And they're all concerned about the kind of data privacy and security and truthfulness of these things. What we're seeing, you know, enterprises do is instead of, again, this like vendor issue that I mentioned with security of like, all right, well, who do we trust the data with? Many aren't willing to say, send it to the ChatGPT multi-tenant instance, and they'll get like a private Azure setup to mitigate some of that risk. You also have prompt injection, which is an unsolved problem. Like you can get out of the system prompt and make the model do weird things, which if you're then kind of using the outputs of the model to call functions or do other actions, like just opens up this big gnarly rat's nest of possible injection attacks. So you have to really treat all of the data coming in or out of these models as untrusted and ensure that you're executing that code in a really safe environment when you're doing it.
Yeah, it's funny because I was just talking to a guy this morning and he was saying how the idea of having a fine-tuned model on your data is like, it's great in theory, but then how do you protect against these things? Like prompt injection can be really bad, or just data access. All of a sudden people have whatever data access they want because they can just prompt the model and it will give them anything. And it's really hard to figure out how to deal with data access on a fine-tuned model on this potentially sensitive data.
Yeah, and often, I mean, some of the coolest use cases are like, all right, the model's going to generate SQL and then you can go and like run that SQL. Well, you better make sure that whatever user's running the SQL only has access to the data, you know, it can have. The model could generate code and execute code. All right, what can the sandbox that code is being run in do? All of these things are important to think about. The other piece I'd say is just having visibility into this is, I think, the most important thing. So, you know, this comes back to the feature that we just released at Weights and Biases, our LLM monitoring tool. We have a proxy now that is like fully compliant with the OpenAI API. So customers can kind of take any of their code that's hitting those APIs, change a couple environment variables, and now everything goes through our proxy and everything is tracked. So we capture, you know, cost by user, and the actual inputs and outputs that are coming from the API. This we like put into Parquet files, which are really easy to kind of ingest in some data pipelines to kind of detect maybe, oh, is someone trying to inject prompts? Is there PII being leaked? Is the model hallucinating, kind of doing offline evaluations? These are other kind of mitigating ways to solve for this.
Excellent. So the other piece that I think is fascinating to dive into when it comes to LLMs and just the journey of weights and biases in general, as you've seen it over the years, it feels like there is, as weights and biases grows, you start to become useful for new personas. And in the beginning, it's like, oh yeah, cool. Like the data scientists slash ML researchers are very interested in this. But then you start to add new functionality and it's like, oh, wait a minute. More engineers are interested. And then LLMs blow up on the scene and now software engineers are interested. And so I'm wondering, like, how do you feel it's different slash the same to build for these different personas? Like, what do you look at when you're trying to evaluate?
From the start, we really targeted one core persona, and it was the ML engineer. And we really targeted like the best ML engineers, right? Like, we were working with the researchers at OpenAI, at companies like Toyota Research Institute in the very beginning, because we knew, you know, the people solving some of the hardest problems, if we can really build tools that help them, the folks that are like just starting their journey with ML are going to benefit from these things and will help them kind of get to the place where they can do as advanced stuff as the leaders in the field. Now, as LLMs have kind of, you know, really opened up the personas,
floodgates, man, for sure.
It is a hard problem. I think there's overlap between, say, the ML engineer and the software engineer, and I think maybe some of the software engineers don't realize it. But, you know, if you're interacting with these APIs or using one of these open source models, you really need to have a formal way to evaluate it.
Ops. You have to immerse yourself in the MLOps content. The best way to do it is to subscribe to the MLOps community podcast. So, good luck and keep learning.
It was like the same problem we had at PowerSet before we started Crowdflower. Like, when you're using a probabilistic engine, and that engine might change over time, and the way you interact with it might change, you need a way to like measure that and know whether or not the thing you're about to push to production is better or worse than it was before. So that is like very aligned with what ML engineers are doing while they're training and evaluating and pushing models. So I think, figuring out ways to really educate and empower those traditional software developers to start thinking a little more like ML engineers is, you know, it's something we did when we were first teaching classes as well. It's something we're familiar with. So that is often, you know, you've got this like really complex tool. How do you hide a lot of the complexity such that people can kind of onboard and then slowly be revealed more of the power features and complexity? I think it's also like a great opportunity to maybe incorporate large language model functionality. So instead of needing to like click around and do 1,000 things, you could just ask the product what to do, and it would do it. We do a hackathon twice a year at Weights and Biases, and next week is our hackathon. So I think I just had my idea for the
hackathon. You go.
Yeah.
You got it. Now team up and you're in it, and you envision it just like the onboarding is you asking, can I do this? Can I do that? How do I do this? What does this look like? And it's basically taking the docs, ingesting the docs, and then also ingesting all those onboarding and making sure that...
Well, that would be more like a chatbot. I think my dream would be like for the really complex UIs, when we've got like 50 different settings for a chart or some way to like compare things, you could just like ask it, you know, show me a confusion matrix of wrong or right answers between the latest three runs or something, and then it generates the appropriate kind of UI elements and queries to do it. But that might be a project that's a little gnarlier than a one-week hackathon, but I don't know. These LLMs are wild, man.
It's a great start to get it rocking, and then if there's value, like, well, you can see. And I guess that is another question, just pulling on that thread a little bit, is how do you figure out if something has value? You hack on that. You're like, wow, I love this, but I don't know if anybody else will. Are you doing these kind of incremental rollouts, as we could say, on your own products and seeing, do the people that are using this, do they find this as valuable as I think they'll find this?
Yeah. So, from the start, we've done, what I guess you could call like demo driven development. So when we have an idea for what we think is going to be useful to folks, we'll put together a prototype. And pieces of it might not actually work, but we try to make it look as good as we can. And then we go sit down with maybe an existing customer, someone that's like friendly and willing to engage, and say, hey, let us tell you the story. And then gauge their reaction and see if they have feedback and kind of guide us to the next step. Then it's often like once we feel convinced enough that yes, this is something that a good enough percentage of the market's going to want, we get it into a functional state. But that's really when the work begins, right? Because it's all about the details, the many, many iterations on different aspects of it that make it great and delightful. And that's just kind of relentless working with customers and looking at what data we can get just from actual usage and being very data-driven and try to like get those numbers up.
Yeah. So for example, let's take this new release that you're coming out with, like the monitoring, right? Or the evaluation. Like, what does that actually mean when you're iterating on it? Is it just UI things? Is it actual API calls? Like, is it where it sits and the full-on functionality? Like, how much are you willing to just go in and butcher a feature if you're getting feedback from your existing customers that say, yeah, we would want this?
Yeah, I mean, we try to be as open-minded and experimental as possible. I think especially when you're running an enterprise software business, there is a danger in just doing every little thing that every company wants. And then suddenly you have this kind of big, disjoint, not unified platform. So we are careful to say like, all right, well, is this reasonable? Do we think other customers will also benefit before we decide to like experiment with something? One thing we know with evaluation is that every use case is very nuanced and different. So you can't just make like an LLM evaluation tool, because depending on what you're asking the LLM to do, it's going to, you know, be a potentially very complex process to perform the evaluation. So all of our new offerings that we've released in the last couple of months have been built on top of this toolkit we made called Weave that is open source, and it's kind of like Streamlit but with actual types and extensibility. So it's like, I won't do any more analogies, but we're building a lot of this new functionality on top of it, which allows us to experiment quickly, and it even allows the customer to kind of customize or change these dashboards themselves. So it's not this hard-coded like React dashboard that then we have to go have people go and change. It's something that is similar to like our current reports functionality. We can kind of go in and tweak and move things around and try to get it, you know, exactly right for your use case.
Yeah, it gives people that flexibility and you're not super opinionated on it. And so then they can say, all right, this is actually what's important to me. And like you said, especially with evaluation, it's case-by-case basis. So you can't just full-on say, this is the evaluation tool and this is how we're going to use it, because that's going to get stale real quick.
Yeah, and I mean, this whole space is moving so quickly. Like, the state of the art on how to evaluate certain use cases could very well, you know, change tomorrow, so.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I know that we put out an evaluation survey about a month ago, and we've had over like 100, like 120 people have written in and said what they're doing, how they're evaluating. And what's funny to me is how one thing that people are, the majority of people are still using these traditional metrics to evaluate. And it feels like those aren't ideal, but it is something that people have just been trained to use. And so that's like, well, I guess it's something. And it's very much, you are seeing this current state of things where people are like, I'm trying to evaluate, but I don't really know if what I'm evaluating is actually making sense. And so there's this huge question mark, at least from what I've been seeing in the data, and that it's all open source. I'll send you the link in a bit because we made all the responses open for anyone to check out. And this data is fascinating to see, like, people are, I don't want to say fully struggling, but you know, like a lot of people are like, oh, we just have a thumbs up, thumbs down, and we're good. And you're like, dude, that's not good enough. That is not how you can call it quits after a thumbs up, thumbs down. That's not going to be like the be all to end all. I just don't see that working that well.
Yeah. I mean, I go back to the early days working on the search engine and the ranking algorithm. How do you evaluate that? Like, how do you know? You know, we ask these users how good a result is. It's very ambiguous. It's like pretty subjective to like take a query and say, okay, how good of a match it is. What you'd see often at like big companies like eBay or a big e-commerce retailer is you have the ML team trying to make the results like really relevant using this like relevance metric, but then you have the business trying to sell product. So it's like ultimately like which product sold. Now, do you want the relevancy or do you want to optimize for, you know, selling more product? And how you align everyone is a real challenge. But what's important is you're like tracking it so that you don't in a month push a button to deploy some new prompt template or a new model and it like tanks whatever, you know, the core business problem was solving.
Yeah, exactly. It's like almost, you just got to make sure of the huge dangers. And then the other stuff, all right, we'll tweak it. We'll make it a little bit better, but it's super subjective. Yeah, we can deal with that. And we're trying to figure that out. But yeah, cover your back first and foremost and make sure
that
it doesn't.
These bugs, like the bugs are so subtle with these ML models because they're like, they're not going to error. They're not going to throw an exception. They're just going to probably, you know, just be like subtly wrong.
Yep.
And that's, it's so hard to detect oftentimes. Yeah,
that's so funny because Rohit, who I was just talking to on the podcast, he was like, maybe we need a new type of HTTP number. You know, it's not like a 404. It's not a 202. It's like a 224 or something that is like, yeah, you got a response, but it's not really accurate response, or it's not like to be trusted. You know, and that's kind of the HTTP that
you think
get.
It's already there. I forget the exact number, but there's an I'm a teapot HTTP code that's in the official spec.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Should look it up.
There we go. That's a nice little what is it, breadcrumb. So as we're moving forward through the landscape of LLMs and the evolution of it, and you traditionally kind of been ahead of the curve on things. You started an ML company in 2007. So that gives you a bit of a track record, I think. Where's your head out right now? What are you thinking about in the landscape and how things are evolving and where they're going?
Yeah, I mean, the space is so exciting. I'm just like always pleased to see, you know, every day something trending on Hacker News that's related to all this stuff and a lot of the interesting papers coming out, the innovations. You know, where all of this is going to end up, I don't know. I think a space that's especially interesting is the open source model space and kind of running these things on the edge. And, you know, selfishly, I'd also love it if lots and lots of companies start fine-tuning these smaller models and they use weights and biases to do it. I think the multimodal stuff is really interesting. Like just playing with ChatGPT with images is like pretty magical. And I think we'll just continue to see more and more modalities being able to be intertwined to do novel things. And it's exciting. I think the other is like these agents. I think they don't work great today, but they're like interesting enough and kind of magical enough that people are, you know, continuing to kind of experiment and work with them. I think as these models get better, the power of the kind of like do anything agent is going to be really interesting and a little scary. But yeah.
Yeah, the agent one definitely has captured, I think, everyone's attention. And in a way it is like you're saying, like it's not good enough yet, but there's enough of a spark to where we realize this could be something. And maybe it's in a few months, maybe it's in a few years, but there's something here and we should pull on that thread a little bit more.
Yeah, totally.
So I see you creating the future, making it happen. Chris, this has been awesome. I really appreciate you coming on here and chatting with me. And last question I have for you. What was Conan O'Brien like when you were an intern on his show back in the day?
It was pretty awesome. It was, you know, it was an unpaid internship. We paid ourselves with access to the soda fridge. And then when we would order dinner for the writers, we could also order dinner for ourselves. So that was our payment. That and like getting to see a bunch of cool movie stars and bump into Conan, who was very tall. He's a very tall human being, but also very kind. And it was, you know, super exciting to get to work there.
Were you a writer? Were you interning as a writer or just as a cameraman? What was your intern?
No, I was a production assistant, which means basically an errand boy. I would get writers coffee. I would go to the Virgin Megastore and buy a CD that they wanted to use in one of the skits. I would like help the prop guys with stuff. It was like anything and everything.
Was Andy Richter around on the show back then?
At that time, he wasn't. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, awesome, dude. What an experience. And thank you so much for coming on here. I appreciate this. And I love everything that you're doing at Weights and Biases. I'm excited for the new features that you're putting out. And I encourage everyone that's listening to go check out this new monitoring and evaluation tooling that you've got, they now have access to. And there's this Weave platform that people can go and mess around with, which is totally open source. So thanks, man. I think we'll cut it there.
I love it, man. Thanks for having me. This is fun.
This is Skyler. I lead machine learning at Health Rhythms. If you want to stay on top of everything happening in MLOps, subscribe to this podcast now. 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 Now.